Welcome to New Books in Journalism. I'm Dave Schwartz, your host, and in this episode, we hear from University of Iowa Assistant Professor Travis Vogan. He's here to discuss his book, Keepers of the Flame, NFL Films and the Rise of Sports Media. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Before we get going too much, just give us a little bit about your background and how you got to where you are now.
Well, my PhD is in film and media studies, and I have a background in documentary film, and I was interested in studying documentary film for my PhD at Indiana University. I did my PhD in the Department of Communication and Culture and in American Studies at Indiana University. And I was interested in documentary, but I was also interested in sports from kind of a cultural and critical studies perspective. And when I was doing coursework, I just started thinking about documentaries that use forms that might be somewhat innovative or experimental, and I've been really fascinated by documentaries like Werner Herzog's The Great Ecstasy of the Sculptor Steiner and Zidane, A 21st Century Portrait, those kinds of things. And NFL Films, to me, was kind of in that conversation, more or less. And so I had an opportunity when I was in a seminar one time to write a paper on NFL Films, and my professor recommended that I get in touch with them to maybe talk to a producer or just talk to somebody in PR, maybe get a fact sheet or just some additional information, because surprisingly enough, their history isn't particularly well documented. And so I gave them a call, kind of not really expecting too much, really. And within 48 hours or 3 days, I was on the phone with Steve Sable, president at the time, and as I learned more and more about the company and its history and the folks involved in it and sort of how it shifted over the years along with the rise of cable television and as the NFL has become such a huge part of pop culture, I decided that it was a pretty interesting story to tell. And so I decided to write my dissertation on it, and then that went pretty well. And so I decided to fold that into a book, or at least try. So that's kind of how I got where I got. So I wasn't always studying sports media specifically. I kind of came at sports media through media studies and American studies. So I don't know. That's a somewhat different trajectory from a lot of the folks in sports communication and sports studies.
The NFL is such a pop culture powerhouse, but academics are sort of just a different beast. How did you go about selling this book as you were ready to pitch it and looking for a publisher? How did you decide to pitch this book?
You know, it was actually a lot easier than you might think. I mean, academic publishers, even though they're nonprofit and part of academia, they also, they want to sell books. And so I think they saw a kind of marketability folded into this project by virtue of its relationship to the NFL. But I think that one of the ways that I kind of pitched it to publishers was by talking about how NFL Films is kind of a nice middle ground or a nice way to kind of bring sports and media into conversation. And surprisingly enough, there's really not a whole lot on the symbiotic relationship between sports and media out there. I mean, there is some great stuff. Michael Oriard's work, obviously, Ron Smith's work, Dan Strebel's work, etc. But there's not enough, or there's not as much as you would think, given its popularity and its pervasiveness. And so the ways that I did it is I just kind of talked about how this topic is a way to kind of bring media studies and sports studies into conversation. And University of Illinois Press, which is where I published the book with, they have strengths in media studies and they have strengths in sports studies and sport history. So it was kind of a natural fit. And I shopped it around to a few places when I was going through the process of deciding whether I was going to transform it into a book. And, some people just totally had no interest in it, and other people had a little bit of interest in it. And I wound up going with Illinois. I was really happy with the decision. I think it was the best place for it, so I was glad to be able to work with them.
The book itself, you note that it's not so much an institutional history, although that history is there, but more a cultural history. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think by cultural history, it looks at how NFL films, or it uses NFL films to look at how pro football has become this kind of cultural monolith, but also to look at the rise of sports media from something that was kind of relegated, or sports television in particular, from something that was kind of relegated to evenings and weekends on the networks to something that's ubiquitous. And NFL films had a lot to do with that. And that's not just a medium-specific move. That's a cultural move that's really kind of shifted how we experience sports, how we imagine sports, what we expect from sports, how sports are packaged, etc. And so that's why I'm looking at it not just as an institutional history, but as a cultural history, really trying to place NFL films in that broader context to explain why it matters beyond just it being a really successful business helmed by kind of interesting and eccentric characters.
So Ed Sable, really the father of NFL films. He wasn't the first to film the NFL, but he did it differently. What did he see in the sport or the movement of the players that others did not?
Well, I think that one of the things about Ed Sable and Steve Sable really kind of brought their aesthetic practices or really kind of codified their signature aesthetic practices. But Ed Sable really saw football as kind of a cinematic event in certain ways. And before Sable, a lot of the representations of football on film through newsreels and even through early television were done in a very kind of straightforward way, linear editing, kind of the marching band type soundtrack, and really kind of the peppy narration. And he saw it as something that was much more kind of potentially visceral and dramatic. And he didn't really think that these newsreels did justice to football's beauty and its violence and its kind of epic quality. And so what he wanted to do is, I think this is a quote of his, or he wanted to represent football the way Hollywood represents war. And the first NFL films, or the first, sorry, Blair Motion Picture was the independent company he started before they were incorporated by the NFL and made it to NFL films. But the first NFL production they did with Blair Motion Pictures was the 1962 NFL championship game. They called it Pro Football's Longest Day. And that was a riff on this film, this war film called The Longest Day, which came out that same year. And so they were very deliberate in attempting to depict pro football in this kind of cinematic and dramatic and epic way. That was kind of from the start. And then Steve Sable, once he came into the picture in a more prominent way, really kind of codified those aesthetic practices with the music, the narration by John Facenda, the kind of poetic scripts that he would write, the editing, the slow motion, etc.
And Ed had that vision, and certainly Steve did as well, but they still had to sell it, and then the old commissioner, Pete Rozelle, had to buy into it. And he was an old PR guy.
Rozelle was a savvy businessman, and he really, in a profound way, understood the power of media in publicizing the National Football League. And this has been well documented in there are a few biographies on Rozelle, and they talk about this at length. But he realized that the NFL at the time was, I think, the third most popular, maybe fourth most popular sport in the country, depending on who you ask. And he realized that if they were going to become kind of a national phenomenon, they had to create an image that would excite people but would also attract a broad audience, etc. And he saw NFL films as, or he saw Blair Motion Pictures at the time as having a real potential to create a sort of mythology that people would use to understand pro football and that would set pro football apart from other sports. And so he really kind of bought into what the Sables were providing early on. And he was instrumental in convincing the league owners to incorporate Blair Motion Pictures as NFL films. So yeah, his PR background and Ed Sable's kind of salesmanship and his background in sales kind of combined in a really complementary way.
So one of their most important films was They Call It Pro Football.
Mm-hmm.
What was the intended goal of that film, and then what actually happened? What did that film do for the league?
Well, that film, Steve Sable calls that film the Citizen Kane of sports movies, and I don't know how. Yeah, it's a really kind of dramatic comparison, and Steve Sable was kind of a master of hyperbole, as you might imagine. But it was really kind of a statement of this is how we're imagining pro football, as this kind of excessive, epic, beautiful, dangerous, violent kind of spectacle. And it's the first film of theirs that used Sam Spence's scores. It's the first film where John Facenda was narrating. It had this sort of poetic script that Steve Sable wrote. He wrote a lot of their early scripts. It was using montage editing and jump cuts and slow motion, and it would focus in on linemen's hands rather than showing the whole play. It would use these telephoto lenses to really focus in on their hands and kind of use the hands almost as metonyms as synecdoches for the whole kind of grit and power that happens in this place they call no man's land. And it was a real statement on what the NFL, or how the NFL should be understood according to NFL films. And it really kind of set the tone for this aesthetic that is still identified with this company and is still evoked all over the place. I think a lot of people might not even be familiar with NFL films, but they're familiar with its kind of signature conventions and how those conventions sort of signal this powerful mythology of football, whether it's a Domino's commercial or a commercial for beer or something like that, that uses the sort of very distinctive score and the slow motion, etc.
And it really, it's in a way, NFL, not even in a way, but NFL films really created the league's history in a sense that, you know that arranging exceptional moments into historical narratives. What are some of the narratives that Sables and Roselle wanted to come out of NFL films?
Well, I think they wanted it to be this organization that fosters a kind of heroism where these men kind of band together to do exceptional things and to kind of create these goosebump inducing types of moments. And they do that through kind of finding these potentially spine chilling or tingling moments and arranging them in ways that kind of amplify that excitement, whether through the narration or the music or the editing, etc. And through repeating those moments over and over and over again in different contexts, something like, I mean, the best example is probably the catch, Dwight Clark, using that moment as a kind of representation of what pro football is all about, and repeating it over and over and over again in different kinds of contexts to the point where it really kind of signals this aesthetic and kind of competitive potential that they use to identify or to build the league's brand.
So is the NFL, I mean, they're filming something real. I mean, the cameras are filming an actual game. So one would think that it might be a documentary, but is what they're putting out a documentary? Is it fiction?
Well, I think insofar as it's producing, indexical images of reality, it is a documentary, and all documentaries are created from a particular perspective. And so yeah, I certainly think it is a documentary, but I think that it's the balance between sort of displaying and framing is very much on the kind of side of depicting it in a very specific, pointed sort of way that ultimately is trying to represent the NFL as a heroic and positive organization. So it certainly is a documentary, but the degree to which it forms that reality that it represents in specific, deliberate ways, I think is palpable. And I think anybody who watches a representation or an NFL films production knows that this isn't actually how football works. It's a very kind of specific rendering of it. And actually, just an anecdote, in the 70s, NFL Films was distributing some of its weekly programs, like they call it Pro Football, or sorry, This Week in Pro Football, and NFL Films presents Game of the Week to Japan. And they were pretty popular in Japan. And apparently there was an exhibition game that was happening over there, and some of the fans were booing when they were watching the game because they were expecting it, or at least this is the how the tale goes. They were expecting slow motion, and they were expecting these kind of powerful hits in the way that NFL Films represents the game. So in that case, the kind of representation sort of superseded reality and wound up disappointing people when they got the genuine article.
But what's really interesting about that is that there's that Steve Sable quote, words like medicine, an overdose could kill you.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that this narrative that they built and this image that they created wasn't done through so much as words as just the editing techniques and how they chose to cut it. And then it goes to show the power that the film editor has, you know, over, you know, what it is, how that message is received.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, if you just kind of juxtapose an NFL Films production with a television broadcast from the 60s or a newsreel from the early 60s, you'll see that the montage editing is one of the ways that they kind of amplify the visceral quality of football. And they actually one of the person who taught Steve Sable how to do this montage editing was a freelancer actually named Yoshio Kishi, who really didn't care at all about football, but was very adept at this kind of editing practice, and he sort of schooled the NFL Films folks on that.
And yet Steve Sable hated television, right? He didn't like the old editing techniques of just how a TV show was put together.
Well,
he's more cinematic.
Yeah, he really wanted to distinguish NFL Films from TV. I mean, NFL Films was incredibly reliant on TV in a lot of ways. That's where their films were shown. There are very few instances where they were actually exhibited in a cinema. So it was very reliant on TV. But I think that he was interested in kind of differentiating NFL Films from sort of the cultural stereotypes that we have surrounding television, especially at that time, as something that's kind of a vast wasteland, as something that's just kind of producing lowest common denominator kind of content. And he wanted people to think of NFL Films as cinema, and he took great lengths to do so. I mean, he was always appealing to the use of film rather than video, the way that film can present a more intimate depiction of something than a video image. He was always referencing filmmakers from Orson Welles and the Citizen Kane comparison to Hitchcock, to Claude Lelouch. He talks about how his montage editing was partly influenced by this Claude Lelouch film called A Man and a Woman. So he was constantly evoking film in an effort to situate NFL Films as part of that tradition, and in doing so to kind of differentiate it from just your run-of-the-mill TV broadcast, to say that this is something special, this is something that's art. And that was really important to him because he did fancy himself an artist. And film was one of the ways that he kind of asserted his role as an artist, or constructed his role as an artist.
And I mean, it's really myth-making, a lot of what mm-hmm. they were doing, you know, the immaculate reception.
Yeah.
You know, just the fact that the cameras weren't at exactly the right angle.
Yeah.
You know, the NFL was able to use that to their advantage, and you know, it's something they continue to do to this day. It's really created this seminal moment in NFL history.
Yeah, and being able to not only capture these moments, but being able to showcase them in a specific and pointed kind of way that really sort of amplifies their meaning, right? Mm-hmm. And so the Immaculate Reception was really just kind of a fluke on the part of that camera operator who was filming from the opposite's end zone. Just decided that he was going to keep shooting. And one of the things that Ed Sable would tell his crews was to let the film run like water, just to shoot everything, right? And he had camera operators up in the stands. He had them on the sidelines. He had them in the crowd. Just shoot everything, he said. And they did that. And sort of following that principle, they would catch some of these shots that have now become real key parts of not just NFL history, but really sports history. I mean, you walk around Pittsburgh and they have statues of the exact angle or from the perspective of the NFL Films camera of Franco Harris, you know, picking the ball up right before it hits the ground, or allegedly. And so they caught a bunch of these interesting things that they might not have otherwise caught. Now, that's changed a lot over the course of its history. I mean, they have to be much more kind of budget conscious now, and especially since film stock has become more scarce and almost extinct. The sort of principles that guide their filmmaking practices have shifted quite dramatically.
The subtitle, NFL Films and the Rise of Sports Media, to locate NFL Films within the rise of this larger institution, that takes some convincing on your part and in your work. What made you feel comfortable locating the NFL Films within this broader context about its overall influence?
Well, I think that NFL Films is growing out of certain things in sports media, and I think it's also contributing to certain developments. Yeah, the subtitle is a bit glib, I think. But I think that it's accurate in certain ways, too, because it developed a bunch of these conventions that we now just kind of take as cultural wallpaper when it comes to sports media. And it also, maybe more importantly, ushered in this sort of custom of having sports on television all throughout the week. These programs that it developed, like Game of the Week and This Is the NFL, etc., were syndicated. And so they would show up all over the place on programming schedules. Oftentimes they were used, you know, in an effort to kind of promote a game, so they might be on a Saturday or something like that. But they would often be used as filler. And so they'd show up during the week, maybe in prime time sometimes, middle of the night, whatever. And I think they kind of helped to establish a market for sports television and non-live sports television, non-event sports television, throughout the entire week and throughout the year, right? And so in that way, I think they kind of helped to usher in this pervasive presence of sports media that we now have. I don't think that they were by any stretch the single factor that led to the sort of ubiquitous presence of sports media, but I think they were part of a broader trend that includes things like ABC Sports and Monday Night Football, which incidentally NFL Films had a hand in helping to make this kind of primetime spectacle. And then the development of ESPN, and NFL Films was one of ESPN's main content providers in its earlier years. I mean, because its syndicated programs were inexpensive, right? Because just like we talked about with Roselle earlier, they were promotion, right? They weren't necessarily looking to make money off of them, or at least that wasn't the principal motivator. It was to positively promote the league. And so ESPN initially didn't have the largest budget. And so this was the only way, or one of the only ways, the draft, for instance, was another one, that they could have kind of inexpensive access to the NFL, which by that time was the most popular sport in the United States. And so NFL Films was all over the place on ESPN earlier on. So it really kind of helped establish ESPN too. So that kind of explains the rationale for the subtitle.
How would you like people who follow your research, who use this book, how would you like to see how would you like to see this book pushed forward?
That's a great question. I think it's part of a huge project in not my project, but our project of the relationship between sports media and popular culture, and I think that this is a part of that project. I think there could be great projects on things like wrestling on television in the 1950s, or the relationship between boxing and television. Dan Strebel wrote a great book that called Fight Pictures on early cinema and boxing. I think that a book on boxing and television needs to be written, or a book on ABC Sports, or um, uh, Gosh, I mean, there are just so many possibilities. I mean, I'll try to write a couple of them maybe, but I just see it as part of a bigger project and part of a larger project that can kind of help us to think through the relationship between sports, media, and culture, and how those things all kind of work together. And so, you know, I'd like to see it be used in that way. I think that, you know, I do think that it would be useful for, you know, undergraduates. It might be more of a graduate style kind of book. But I think that as a scholarly project, I see it as being linked to these sort of intersecting traditions in sports studies and in media studies. And I think that as far as kind of a contribution goes, I'd really like to see it become part of a larger body of work that looks at the relationship between sports media and that brings together media studies and sports studies. And I really do think that we're going to see more work in that direction as the years go on. I just think it just seems to make a lot of sense to me, and it seems to be a curiously understudied and a part of popular culture. And I think that as academia becomes a little more accepting of it, and as people realize, wow, there's a lot here that I can say, not just about sports and media, but about just kind of popular culture more generally, I think we're going to see more work in that direction. And hopefully this will play some small role there.
I was kind of chuckling. I was looking at how Amazon has this book placed.
Oh, yeah.
You know,
yeah.
There's this NFL book. You know, you go to a bookstore and it's, you know, like, look in the sports books, and it's baseball, it's football, it's golf, and it's everything else.
Right.
And at some point, you know, it's more of an academic book, more of a especially a graduate level book.
It's hiding, and
it's hiding, and then someone's going to pull open this book, and they're going to be hit with things
totally
like
totally disappointed,
Bourdieu and Adorno, and all these. And, you know, and you're somewhat of a sports fan as well.
Sure.
You know, was it at all? I mean, just your personal experience of writing the book, was it? How did you do that? How did you balance, you know, your own just experience of consuming sports with now applying all these academic principles and theories to it?
Yeah, it kind of took the fun out of it in a way. No, it's, you know, that wasn't really much of a problem for me, because honestly, I'm probably more interested in issues of history and culture than I am in sports. I'm a sports fan, but I didn't really, if anything, I thought that something like Bourdieu and Foucault and the other theorists who come up intermittently really kind of enriched it. One of the things that I tried to do, because a big fear I had with this book is that it was going to really disappoint some of the fans who read it, and they would read it and be like, oh man, what is this thing? Why is he ruining football for me? Or why does he have to talk about it in this way? And I don't think it's a particularly heady book, although maybe it does have a few moments that get a little bit abstract. But one of the things I wanted to do was to make it something that that both fans or people who have a casual interest in sports history would be able to enjoy, but that would also make a scholarly contribution. And so trying to toe that line was actually a really interesting challenge for me as an academic, because oftentimes we're afforded this ability to write in kind of complex ways, and maybe sometimes overly complex ways. And so it was a really nice exercise for me to try to write in a way that could satisfy both a general and an academic audience. I don't know if I've done that because the book just came out, but I have gotten a couple emails from people who aren't academics, and they've had nice things to say. So that was a real relief, because that was one of my big concerns, is that people were going to buy the book and be disappointed because it was just this kind of, you know, egghead academic, you know, meditation on something that they think should be pretty exciting and lively. And I tried to do justice to that. At the end of the day, though, it is, you know, I do consider it to be primarily, you know, an academic, a historical, a cultural contribution. And so I think it kind of weighs on the academic side ultimately, but I've been happy that the responses I've gotten so far from folks who aren't academics have generally been positive.
You have such a deep history with this book and the subject of it, how far back you started looking at the ideas with it. And when you were going through archives and other historical research, was there anything that at any point that surprised you?
The biggest surprise for me, I think, was in how the NFL Films Archive kind of works. I have a chapter. It became a whole chapter.
The wine cellar.
Yeah. And it was just so surprising to me how they organize their footage. They have a digital cataloging system that organizes footage just like any other cataloging system where you have dates and names and teams and all the stuff you'd expect. But they also have cataloging, and I'm still just blown away by this. I just think it's amazing and genius. But they also have cataloging systems according to like the intensity of the footage or like its potential to impact viewers. So it's like good, really good. And then I think the most exciting is, oh God, I think is the one. And they also have cataloging terms according to their conventions. So shots of hands, for instance. And I just thought that was so fascinating. And it makes absolute sense because they're working out of a tradition. You know, they have their conventions that they follow. And that's what makes them NFL films in a lot of ways. But it's a unique way of kind of organizing footage. And it really speaks to this stable mythology that they've kind of created, that it's embedded in their archive. So if I'm a producer at NFL Films and I'm making a highlight film on a particular team, and I said, oh man, I just really need a shot of hands right here. This would be a great moment to have the shot of hands or like muddy cleats or something. You can sort of type in the system hands and look and see if there's a shot that's been flagged of the team that you're working with from a particular year with hands of a lineman or something like that. Or if you want to do something on, you know, let's say that they're doing something on like Lawrence Taylor and they want to see like Lawrence Taylor muddy, you know, they can do that conceivably. And that just kind of blew me away when I found that out. And they thought this is a sort of a custom there and they've been doing it for a while. And the folks at NFL Films thought it was kind of weird that I was so like blown away by this archive. But I was like, you don't realize it's so different from anything else I've ever seen. And so I decided to write an entire chapter on it.
Well, I couldn't, when I thought about it and I saw how detailed the archive things oh God, that moment. And you know how they had some, you know, I mean, they used to produce videos just on big hits.
Yeah.
And I thought someone's going to read this and then NFL Films is going to be subpoenaed. You know, and you know, and the
well, they
the,
already have.
Yeah, I mean, I guess, yeah, and just to get all this archived footage of the hits to the head and the concussion.
Well, they're part of that litigation. Right. You know, they were named in the suits with the former players, etc. Mm-hmm. And yeah, they did. They have films called Crunch Course. They had a film called the Headcracker Suite, which was kind of based on the Nutcracker Suite and sort of a takeoff on the theme and. Bell ringers. I mean, you know, just stuff that we hear about now and we're just like, oh man, you can't do that. But they, you know, they obviously don't do that anymore. But that was a big part of their business. I mean, those big hit films were a sort of subgenre of NFL films. And, they were a big part of kind of celebrating the sort of heroism of the league, just like in general, where we, you know, a powerful hitter, is someone who can knock someone around and someone who's tough is going to get back up and get back in the game. I mean, they were definitely a part of that. And they've made adjustments just like anybody else has. But I think that, you know, I think that there's a degree of culpability there for them, just like there is for the rest of the league. I think that NFL Films is maybe a little bit different from the rest of the league because they're not responsible in the way that the league should be for sort of researching the health effects of these kinds of things. They're sort of, you know, just celebrating the league as best they can. I don't want to let them off the hook here necessarily, but it seems like the league is probably more responsible for having to do that kind of research, et cetera, et cetera. But the NFL Films certainly helped to create that mythology and they've been named repeatedly in those suits and in complaints.
Yeah. In a lot of ways, they're the stenographer of the NFL, but if the stenographer has more ability to create.
Yeah, they aren't just recording. They're not just documenting, but they do document. I mean, they have filmed every game since they were incorporated. Every single NFL game has had at least one NFL Films camera there, and most often more than one. So, I mean, they've made it. Steve Sable used to brag that they've made it the most comprehensively documented endeavor in human history. And this, you know, who knows if it's true. This is just kind of how he rolled in terms of his sort of grandiose statements. And that's what made him such a, I mean, he's a myth maker by trade. But I mean, it's profound how carefully and closely documented the NFL is because of them.
This is really interesting, and we're coming toward the end, but yeah. One thing I want to touch on is there's this really interesting dynamic that takes place where NFL films was so important to the meaning of the NFL. And as NFL has grown over the decades to the fourth or fifth most popular sport, by far the most popular sport in America, in a sense, it's eaten NFL films. To the fact that the more powerful the NFL has grown, the less meaning NFL films has.
Yeah, in a way, it's kind of a victim of its own success, you could say. I think that the mythology, the NFL is still very much reliant on that kind of foundation of the NFL as this beautiful, competitive, kind of macho game full of camaraderie and overcoming obstacles, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, and NFL films was a part of that. But the NFL has also become even more of a content producer. They started the NFL Network and NFL Media, really, which is their big media operation. That NFL Films is now kind of ensconced in, along with online, mobile, the network, etc. And they've really kind of shifted their attention to NFL day-to-day NFL news, right? And so NFL Films is more kind of historical, drawn-out kinds of representations of the league have become less relevant to its priorities in terms of representing itself on a day-to-day basis. Now, that's not to say that NFL Films content doesn't exist any longer or isn't on the NFL Network or other places, but it's less important to the league's kind of day-to-day efforts to publicize itself. And so, in a way, it kind of helped to definitely led to the creation of things like the NFL Network. But now its sort of signature conventions, its signature practices are less important to that media infrastructure. And when the NFL Network started, they said that just it's kind of an interesting parallel to when ESPN started. NFL Films was all over the place. But then they started developing their own content, their own kind of news stuff, the talk shows, etc. And NFL Films kind of faded into the background, and now it's in less popular time slots. You see it during the daytime, etc. And it has been kind of a victim of its own success. In NFL Films, more and more, its staff is producing stuff that doesn't really look like traditional NFL films. And I think that in a way, it's, you know, some people are outraged by this, and some people realize that it's just kind of a natural outgrowth of its success, and even a testament to its success in certain ways.
Before his death, did Steve Sable recognize where NFL Films was going? Was he aware that it was changing so dramatically?
Yeah, I think so. He did say a couple of things that indicated that he was aware of NFL Films as kind of steady, not necessarily decline, but its transformation into something quite different from what they'd imagined it to be. He tended to be maybe overly optimistic and jolly in the sound bites that he gave. So I don't think that he would necessarily target the league or blame the league. And in fact, he was, from what I read, from when I talked to him about it, he was incredibly enthusiastic about the NFL Network. He thought this was great. He said something to the effect that this is the all you could ever want if you're a filmmaker. They're going to give us carte blanche, et cetera, et cetera. And he was really excited about it, or at least he presented himself as excited about it. Now, that wasn't really the case, but I don't think he, at least publicly, ever really kind of expressed any kind of discontent with the league and how it handled NFL Films. And I think they did give him, a degree of autonomy, at least in sort of running NFL Films. And then later, I think that they kind of tightened or shortened his leash a little bit, and they started bringing more administrative types to Mount Laurel from New York to kind of oversee mm-hmm. things and pay closer attention to budgets and stuff like that. Because as I understand it, and from what people have told me at NFL Films, he was not a businessman. He was not like his father. He didn't really care about that stuff. He just wanted to make movies. You know, he was a painter on the side, all these kinds of things. And he just was not the most adept administrator. So he didn't really want to be bothered with that stuff.
So at last, the book is done and it's out.
The book is done, yeah.
it's on the bookshelf now. What's next for you?
Well, I'm working on a book that kind of grew out of this one. It's called, or tentatively calling it, ESPN Culture. And it's about how ESPN builds sort of refinement and prestige and authority through engaging media and traditions that are typically understood as having greater cultural value than sort of run-of-the-mill sports media. So I'm looking at documentaries, and I'm looking at how they publish books and sponsor film festivals and long-form journalism. They hired Hunter S. Thompson and David Halberstam, and it's been a really fun project. It's under contract. I'm going to do this one also with Illinois. It's under contract with Illinois, and so hopefully I'll get through it soonish, and we'll get it out, I think, in the next couple of years or something. But yeah, it's been a lot of fun, and it grew kind of directly out of this when I was thinking about all the ways that NFL Films kind of tries to separate itself from other sports media outlets. And I got interested in things like 30 for 30 and the ESPN documentaries that they're producing. And so it was a nice kind of steady transition into another book project. So yeah, I'm excited about it.
Well, this book, Keepers of the Flame, NFL Films and the Rise of Sports Media. Travis Bogan, thanks for joining.
And as always, thanks for listening to New Books in Journalism, part of the New Books Network. You can find Keepers of the Flame, written by Travis Bogan, at Amazon and other retailers.